You are listening to episode 83 of the Tennis Vaz podcast with special guest Paul Annacone.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Tennis Files Podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Tennis Files Podcast. I really appreciate you tuning in, as always. I hope you're getting to play a lot of tennis these days. I've been actually playing a lot more myself. I've gotten a bit more free time lately, which is great. So I've been playing a bunch of tennis with my friend Will Hamilton from Fuzzy Yellow Balls and my friend Victor from college, and I'm playing some more USA League matches, which is a lot of fun. I had a block time yesterday, and block time is actually just another name for a consistent practice that you can set up with your club where you buy a season's worth of court time and then you kind of rotate with your group. So that's a great fun for me. I play with a bunch of friends that I have made in the USA leagues in one of the counties that I play in often, as well as with my friend Victor, as I mentioned. And over the past few days, I've actually been trying to really practice my weaknesses and things that I'm not comfortable with doing. So I made it a point to practice things like just consciously trying to hit more backhands and just serving and volleying more. And it's really worked. You know, I think a lot of times we have weaknesses, but it ends up that they're weak a lot of times because we're not getting enough reps, or of course, maybe we're not getting enough quality reps. But a lot of times, the more that you hit something, the more you get the feel for it and the more you get confident in it. So I really would highly encourage you to, you know, when you go out there, to focus and hone in on what is it that you need to work on and actually work on that, or work on things that you are uncomfortable with, because otherwise you're just hitting the same shots and not really improving and evolving, which is what's really important. So given all that, which I hope you enjoyed, I would like to turn it over to Paul Annacone, and myself, of course. So as I did in a previous episode, I'd like to bring to you this interview with Paul Annacone. I had actually spoken to him last year on Tennis Summit 2018, and he's really a wonderful guy. I actually found it really cool that I only spoke with him once, but I then later on saw him at the City Open in Washington, D.C., and he immediately recognized me, which I thought was cool because, I mean, Paul has coached Pete Sampras, Tim Henman, and Roger Federer. And it's just incredible, you know, like the people, the greatest players in our generation that he's coached. And he's just still such a nice guy that he remembered me and he greeted me very warmly. And I thought that was just super cool. And I remember too, after he greeted me and I was waiting at the registration table to get my press credentials, when he left and I hadn't even saw him, he tapped my shoulder too and said bye. So, you know, this is just evidence that he's a great guy. And also, I know he's worked with my friend Othman Garma, who was on the podcast a couple years ago, actually, now, and just all around great feedback from everybody. And you can just tell from watching Paul on the commentate and on YouTube and wherever else that he's super knowledgeable, very accomplished, and also very humble. So today I'm going to provide this episode for you to listen to because I think it's really going to shed some light into the top habits and characteristics of the best players in the world that Paul has coached, which is Tim Henman, Pete Sampras, and Roger Federer. He's guided them to numerous Grand Slam titles and, you know, Masters 1000 titles, etc. So what I want you to do is to listen carefully to the habits and characteristics of these great players and also Paul's philosophies and try to implement that into your game and your approach to improving. So I think that's probably a good enough intro for you. And so I hope you really enjoy this episode. And so without further ado, here is my interview with Paul Annacone.
Hey, everybody. I'm Mehrban Iranshad, and we're here at Tennis Summit 2018 with Paul Annacone to talk about the winning strategies and habits of the greatest tennis players in the world. It's truly an honor to have Paul on the summit. Paul is extremely accomplished in both his professional playing and coaching career. Paul has coached several of the greatest tennis players in the world, including Tim Henman, Pete Sampras, and Roger Federer. Paul guided Roger to two straight year-end championships in 2010 and 2011. He also helped Roger get back to the number one world ranking and to win his seventh Wimbledon championship. And incredibly, Paul also guided Pete Sampras to seven Grand Slam titles, if I'm not mistaken. In addition to all his coaching accolades, Paul was also a world-class tennis player. He reached number 12 in the world in singles and number three in doubles. And Paul also won the Australian Open doubles title in 1985, and he also reached the Wimbledon quarterfinals as well, amassing three singles titles and 14 doubles titles in his playing career. And Paul also recently published a fantastic book called Coaching for Life, where Paul talks about his experiences with the great champions he has coached, as well as his own playing career as well, to give readers kind of a blueprint on how to overcome challenges and succeed in both tennis and in life. And he's also got a great website at paulanacone.com as well that you all should definitely check out. So, Paul, welcome to Tennis Summit 2018. It's really a pleasure and an honor to have you on the summit today.
Well, Mirvan, thanks so much for the invitation. What a great introduction. Man, that was pretty good stuff. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, I tried to do your research, and obviously I've seen you a ton of times on TV and all that, so I'm sure a lot of the fans know a lot about you. So, but today we're thankful that we're going to learn about, the greatest habits and processes of the world's greatest players, as well as yourself as well. And so we're really pleased to have you on, Paul. And so I guess the first question that I want to ask you is actually, what was one of the most, one of the toughest stretches in your career? Because obviously we all can learn a lot about adversity and how people have overcome. So what was one of the toughest periods of your career, and how were you able to overcome it?
You know, it's amazing. They always, you have all these millions of cliches like, if I only knew now, what I didn't know then. And you have to figure out how to mix and match experience with what goes on. And I think probably the hardest thing for me is there was a time when I had surgery, on my foot. I think I was about 28, kind of in the meat of my career, and it knocked me out for about 7 months. And that was kind of the first time I saw my mortality and my sporting mortality, and realized that this could end at any moment. And so in many ways, that was a pretty good reality check for me. After that surgery, I then had another surgery literally like 4 months after I started playing, because I had another issue with my elbow. And then subsequently, I think about 3-4 years later is kind of when I stopped. I herniated a disc in my back, which really was about the, which no pun intended, but that was the straw that broke the camel's back, or broke Paul's back. But all of those things really taught me a lot of stuff. But that first little hurdle of adversity with the surgery was pretty startling, because you take your health and everything for granted. And as an athlete, most of us play since we're really young. And so that's all you really know. Then all of a sudden at 28, you see that window of your mortality starting to close. It's pretty sobering. So really what I did is I tried to just appreciate the moment when I started playing again. And also, I think I got to be a little bit more of an expansive thinker. And that's probably when I really started thinking about, what do I want to do when I stop playing tennis? Because I had some time to look through things. So it gave me a wider view of life's kind of daily occurrences and what else is out there other than tennis. So although adversity is a hurdle, I think it can be a great learning tool. And as you mentioned, the players that I've been fortunate enough to coach have all been unbelievably good about dealing with adversity and accepting things that they can't change, and doing their best to impact things that they can change. and then being really pragmatic about all the stuff as it evolves, all the different tidbits of information that you have to process. And look, as you know, in the world of tennis, every week in the world of professional tennis, everyone leaves a tournament annoyed except one person. So it's not great odds. So you better be pretty good at dealing with winning and losing. And that's why so much of my philosophy about coaching and so much about, you know, about the book that I wrote, Coaching for Life, is really about process orientation versus just result orientation. And if you really buy into your process, the results will take care of themselves. You know, everyone's goal in life should be to get the most out of themselves and whatever your potential is, to get as close as you can to that potential as possible. So if you dictate your processes clearly and you stick with them and you let the results take care of themselves, that's going to be a good recipe. And I found that, you know, those great players that you mentioned, the Tim Henmans and Federers and Sampras's, are pretty amazing at doing it. And there's not one way to do it. There's lots of different ways, but they all have a lot of faith in what they do. And they're all very pragmatic about the occurrences that kind of jump up along the way.
That's wonderful advice, Paul. I really appreciate that. And you mentioned your first setback physically. And I'm curious, you know, you just mentioned processes. So is there anything, because I know it sounds like you definitely had a sort of a mental shift after that, but did you change anything in particular in your processes or your daily habits or anything like that after your first setback to help you, you know, come back even stronger?
You know, I actually think what I did is initially actually started working too hard. I actually wanted things too badly. And I think that was one of the shifts I had to make, was that there's a big difference between working hard and working smart. And at 27, 28, you think you know a ton. And then when you have a little bit of fear instilled in your process that your career could be over, then you really put your kind of foot on the gas. And I worked really hard. But if anything, I kind of overtrained. I overtrained a little bit. But more importantly, I kind of forgot what got me to be a really world-class player. And I tried to spend way too much time on things that I didn't do well on the tennis court. And that's a dangerous thing, because what happens is if you don't do things well and you spend a ton of time on them, it gets pretty frustrating because you're not giving yourself very much positive reinforcement. So it took me a while to start to learn how to get the balance of shoring up my weaknesses, but don't forget what your strengths are and make sure you maximize them.
That's great stuff, Paul. And I'm just curious to dig a little deeper in that. I mean, I know that, you know, obviously you were a great serve and volleyer. But so when you talk about kind of overtraining, what areas did you kind of maybe cut back on a bit so that you were ensuring that you were just that you were training maximally on your strengths and things like that?
Well, I think what I started to do is I got pretty over the top about kind of off-court training. I spent a lot of time running. I spent a lot of time on the track. I lost a ton of weight. And I thought that this aerobic conditioning would be great for me, when in actuality, I think I went a little bit too far with that. And I lost some of the power in my movement. And I was training in a way that probably wasn't suited to my style of tennis game. And so what happened was I had a better aerobic base, but I kind of lost a little bit of explosivity kind of ness, a little bit of the explosiveness, the ability to really cover the net and do things that got me to where I was. So it, look, there's, you know, I just think that anyone that thinks that there's one answer to everything's in for a rude awakening, and especially in tennis, when you get so much information, things constantly shift. You know, when you have to be really thoughtful and on your toes to be kind of pragmatic and kind of really unemotional about reacting to your environment. Because if you let emotion kind of flood in, I find that it's very difficult to progress because you have too many highs. Too many lows, and the highs are there. But the biggest thing is the difference between the two is so vast that it really kind of beats you up. It becomes an emotional roller coaster.
Right, Paul. And so Pete talked about how you're, you know, very even keel guy. And so to kind of build upon the point, I mean, what were some things that you maybe did in your daily life that helped you stay even keel? Because it's really tough, especially on the tour. I mean, there's a lot of things that I think normal tennis players would be driven insane about, like the pressures to win and get the points mm-hmm. and get the money. So what are some things that maybe we could take away from what you did to become more even keel?
Well, I think part of it was getting comfortable in that environment. Look, everybody's environment's a little bit different. And as you go through your process as a pro tennis player, things change, expectations, pressures, both self-imposed and what's real. And so for me to be with Pete, initially I was pretty young. I think I was 32 when we started together. And his ex-coach who was battling brain cancer at that time, mm-hmm. Tim Gullickson, was a great mentor to me. He really helped me understand the way to go through all of these great experiences, but pressure-packed ones. You know, Pete was supposed to win everything. So that adds a lot of pressure when you are at tournaments and then you have appearances and sponsor commitments. And so for me, you know, the habits that I had, I really kind of go back to my parents mostly. They're both school teachers. And I think the biggest thing is I had a pretty good grasp. I hate to use this term, but just kind of a grasp on reality. You know, it's sports are great and I want to maximize my potential. I want to help maximize my players' potential. But life is life. There's a lot of stuff out there. And if you are fear-based, whether it's fear of failure or fear of success, you're going to struggle. And so I tried to minimize the pressure by understanding there's tons of opportunities. And if you work hard and you work smart, there's going to be lots of opportunities to come, regardless of what happens on that day.
Right, Paul. And I'm actually just curious, obviously, it sounds like your parents had a great impact on you. Maybe what's one thing that sticks in your head that either of your parents told you that you kind of take forward with you as you go forth?
Yeah, I had a good balance. My mom was pretty emotional and pretty driven, and she was the one that pushed my career really hard when I was younger, and I went to Balotelli's for 4 years in my development. And my dad was the more kind of, I would say, stoic and kind of pragmatic personality. So I got the balance of the passion and the energy from my mom. And I probably got a little bit more of the expansive kind of retroactively evaluating things on an even keel from my dad. So I got a little bit of both. And that helped a lot. And also my brother who coached me is 5 years older. He was very even keeled and he was really smart about how he went through things. So I never felt an inordinate amount of pressure. He helped me kind of release that pressure. And when I felt pressure, it was mostly from myself. I basically did it myself. I put it on myself. So that made it difficult. So I think it was a combination of those three people, my dad, my mom, and my brother, that really helped give me a nice balance.
That's wonderful, Paul. And so obviously, you know, it's really important to start the day off right. And, you know, you were a world-class athlete and now a world-class coach. And so I'm curious about if you had any particular sort of morning routine that kind of helped you, you know, start the day off strong.
Yeah, I'm actually a morning person. I have been for a long time. So I actually like to start the morning, and I have historically, kind of by myself, you know, just I start the morning, whether it's with just like a healthy breakfast or a workout, and I've done that for years. And a lot of that came from my college coach, Mike DePalmer Sr., because he liked to do morning workouts. And I felt like I did my most kind of impactful self-evaluation and also kind of thinking in the morning, kind of before lunch. I seem to be most kind of tuned in. And so because of that, my morning routine has been pretty similar the last kind of 20, 30 years, which is wake up, exercise, take a moment, go through my to-do list, and then just think about things that I wanted to try to accomplish on that day, both kind of micro and also macro. And so I try to make sure that I build on that stuff, which is, I think, good for me, because it created good habits. It created habits that helped me know myself better. Some people aren't very good morning people, so they prefer, you know, and I don't think you can necessarily change everything about that kind of person that you are. So you have to figure out when you do your most impactful thinking and working, and kind of structure and prioritize your day so you can maximize those moments. But mine, I'm pretty clear about, and I seem to stick, I've stuck with it for a pretty long time.
Yeah, it sounds like a great way to start the day, you know, the exercise and figuring out what you want to accomplish. And it's definitely made a great impact in my life, too, to keep it consistent in the morning. So obviously, you know, we mentioned Roger, Pete, and Tim. I kind of wanted to dive in with Tim first and just want to ask you, you know, what character trait or traits in particular made Tim such a world-class athlete?
You hit the nail on the head. He was an amazing athlete. He was a great mover. One of the lightest people on his feet in terms around a tennis court back in the day when he, you know, when people actually came to the net often in tennis. Tim was great at that. He was a great volleyer. He was very athletic, tremendous hand-eye coordination. And I think one of his best attributes that people don't really know is he's one of the most optimistic people around. He really appreciated and appreciates life and enjoyed what he was doing. And I think that helped him deal with pressure. It helped him deal with failure and success. And I think it drove him on a day-to-day basis because he had a good time doing things. But that athleticism and that movement and the ability to be so good at the net were probably his biggest strengths.
That's great stuff, Paul. And obviously, you know, there was a lot of pressure. I mean, he had several semifinal results at Wimbledon and other places. And I was wondering to, you know, how you kind of saw him deal with that, like that huge pressure really of just especially playing in his home court.
Yeah, it was hard. You know, he, you know, obviously before Andy Murray, so he had a ton of pressure and he, every time Wimbledon came around, you have to realize England is a country with a ton of newspapers and a ton of tabloids. And so, you know, there was a lot of rhetoric and there was a lot of speculation, pontification, all this stuff every time Tim would play. And he's a caring, sensitive guy. And I think it was really hard on him. One of the things I tried to implore him to do was to not look at the press, particularly kind of the month before Wimbledon until the month after Wimbledon, so that he didn't have to deal with the monumental highs and lows. And so I, you know, people often talk to me about, you know, and there's a lot of folks that I've heard from England too say, you know, that he wasn't a success. He was a huge success. He would be one of my models of professionalism, one of my top, because he got to be ranked 4 in the world. And that's probably where his talent was. He wasn't as talented as Andre or Pete. He wasn't quite in that category. He was just below that. And that's where he got. So his macro goals, I think, were achieved. The micro goal of winning Wimbledon or an event wasn't achieved. And he had, you know, he had a few tough losses to Pete. He had a tough loss to Goran Ivanišević in the finals in 2001, I believe, Wimbledon. I'm sorry, in 2001 in the semifinals to Goran. So that was a tough one. But did he do anything glaringly wrong? No. And so my whole philosophy is, you know, my dad taught me this, which is, you know, whatever you're pursuing, you want to exhaust all your resources to give yourself the best chance to achieve those goals. And I think that's exactly what Tim did. And so for him, I would think he sleeps quite well at night.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure he definitely gave it his all. And so with Tim, you know, obviously you mentioned, just like you, he was such a great servant volleyer. And I'm curious, especially maybe if there's a few takeaways from his serve and volley game, you know, what in particular did he do at the net or any sort of strategy that he employed at the net that made him such a successful serve and volley player?
Well, technically his volleys were really sound, both forehand and backhand. His movement at the net is incredible. I mean, unbelievably light on his feet, really has incredible anticipation. And most importantly, he understands all of the angles and ways to cover the net. He was a great mover after the volley. So he covered the shot that most likely was going to happen next extremely well. So when you combine all those things, it's a pretty good recipe to become a great volleyer.
Gotcha, Paul. And so how did Tim kind of differ from Pete in maybe his demeanor or, you know, how he looked before a match or anything like that?
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
I think Pete was much more introspective, a little bit quieter, a little bit more to himself. Tim's a very gregarious personality and enjoys lots of people and being around lots of people. But both of them were very, professional. Both guys were really good about preparation, equipment, mental, physical, nutritional. There wasn't really much of a different in that area. And so when I look at all the different players, Roger, Pete, and Tim, and, you know, even Sloan, the people that I've been around, you know, everybody's preparation, their personality traits are different, but they tick the boxes in terms of being prepared. You know, are they mentally prepared? Are they nutritionally prepared? Have they done all their work? Is their mind focused? So there's different ways to get there, but as long as they get there for their personality, for me, that's a check in the box.
Good stuff, Paul. And so maybe a tough question, but what do you think was the key to Pete maintaining the number one ranking for so long?
I think he became really comfortable there. I think it took him a while. You know, he told me it took him a while after he won the U.S. Open in 1990 to get kind of clear in his conscience what he was playing for and why. And first it was mostly about trying to win as many majors as he could. And then all of a sudden he became number one. And then all of a sudden he was on track to break Jimmy Connors' record of being year-end number one 5 years in a row. So Pete inevitably did it that sixth year. So Pete did it 6 years in a row at number one, which he thinks, and I probably would agree, that might be his greatest accomplishment, because you kind of only get one chance at that. You know, you can only be 6 years in a row number one probably, no matter how long your career is, probably only once. The major totals for Pete at 14 was spectacular, but you play four a year. So if you don't win one, you have lots of other chances. So we've had some interesting conversations about that, which I find very provocative. But the biggest theme is he got comfortable being number one. He didn't stress out about it. You know, he didn't sit around and look at the ranking points every week. He knew that if he maximized the major events, then he was probably going to finish number one that year. And so he really just kind of went through his process in a really thoughtful manner, like he did everything else. And like I said, became comfortable at number one. It's a tough phrase to grasp, but to understand what it feels like to be number one and be okay with it without panicking, without looking over your shoulder, without worrying, without being neurotic. I mean, it's a hard position to be in. It's great, but it's also complicated, and it takes a unique person to manage that. And Pete did it very well.
That's great stuff, Paul. And so you mentioned in a previous interview that you've never really seen an athlete have greater focus than Pete Sampras out of pretty much anybody you've coached, and that he was able to focus during the most critical and pressure-packed moment. So, I mean, what in particular helped Pete to be able to, focus in these moments?
I think he really understood his environment. Like, I think Roger's an incredible at it as well, but they have very different environments. Like, Roger's environment is very busy. Federer has he's a global icon. He embraces who he is much more than as a brand. Much more than Pete did when Pete played. And Roger came to grips and has come to grips with it And when Roger's on the court, though, he's very good about keeping things, you know, in a monofocus and tunnel vision. Pete, in order to do that, wanted to keep his life outside the courts pretty much like that as well. So when Pete got into the biggest moments, he was very clear about what he did well, and he didn't let anything jeopardize that. And ultimately, he got to the point in his career where he really believed. He's one of the few athletes. Roger's like this too now, but there's very few athletes. There's a very common phrase that says, "Oh, it's going to be really fun out there. I'm going to enjoy this." But I can tell you firsthand, when I walked on the center court at Wimbledon playing Jimmy Connors, it's frightening. It's hard to really enjoy that. And I think the greatest of athletes really do. So it's one thing to enjoy it. It's another thing to really trust your skills in that moment. And that's what Pete did incredibly well. In the biggest moments, he just felt he's going to come up with the biggest shots. And that's a hard trait to teach somebody. And I think he got better at it because he was there so often.
That's great stuff, Paul. And so were there any maybe non-tennis things that Pete did that helped him develop his focus even more? Did he, for example, read or do anything artistic or anything like that?
No, I think Pete kind of embraced who he was and who he is. He knew he had to have a pretty controlled environment, didn't like a million people around all the time. He was very organized and very methodical about his structure. He enjoys sports and appreciates excellence and athletes that excel. So basketball and football players and people that excel, he enjoyed that. But I think his understanding of himself was one of the biggest driving factors, is that he knew what he liked in his life and what he didn't, and he kept it pretty simple.
And so how was Pete able to pretty much dominate with the serve and volley game in the face of, obviously, you know, a lot more baseliners? I mean, what did he do that was so special that helped him succeed like that?
Well, he kind of played at the end of the serve and volley era. I think he probably had the best second serve I've ever seen under pressure. He just believed in the biggest moments that he could hit a 118-mile-an-hour second serve against Andre in the corner, you know, an inch from both lines. And he trusted that. And so I think because he trusted that and because he was successful and able to fail enough times but keep doing it, that's the trick. You have to be able to fail enough times without it crushing your confidence so you can keep getting better at it. And that's what Pete did. And I think that, you know, he was a tremendous athlete with an incredible serve, and with the ability to really focus in such a narrow scope at the biggest moments. And that's a very challenging trait to teach, but I think it comes from being there often and from believing in yourself and doing all the hard work. And that's kind of what he did.
Great stuff, Paul. And so this next question might help more of the players who are tend to be of a calm demeanor like Pete, but obviously you were with Pete for so many matches, Paul. And so, you know, what was Pete's kind of ritual before matches? Like, what were the things that he would do maybe the hour, 2 hours before and a few minutes before?
Well, you know, the match day, you go for your warm up, you get the body going, and then he would hit for anywhere from 25 to 40 minutes. And then after that, it's usually, you know, a light meal. And then in the locker room right before, you know, literally, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes before, you know, to re-gripping the rackets, getting the mind focused on what you're about to do. And then the last kind of 5 to 10 minutes, it's just getting the feet and body going to get the blood, you know, to get the pulse rate up and get ready to go out in the court. So he was pretty consistent about always doing that. Actually, all those guys were. Roger's the same way. Roger, you know, do his warm up, then have a meal a couple hours before he plays, make sure his rackets, equipments, and everything were ready. And then the last hour before he plays the match, just a quick review of what's going on, then, you know, what the strategy was, and then just get the body ready, get out in the court.
That's great stuff, Paul. This one is more of like a, I guess, fun/interesting question. But what did Roger and Pete have like a go-to meal before their matches?
No, it's usually complex carbs, you know, usually pasta, just and not a ton of it, you know, just enough to top things off. And, you know, a couple hours before they play, just a pasta and something complex and, you know, they can get into their system for energy. Obviously, the hydration part's really important, making sure there's a lot of fluids in their system leading up to the match. But it wasn't like that the same thing all the time.
Good stuff, Paul. And so I think it was Roger that, you know, had a great, gave a great review on your book, and you mentioned how you both would set goals. And I was just wondering, you know, how your approach to setting goals with Roger, you know, how you went about that, you know, was that at the beginning of the year or, and also, you know, how big were the goals that you all would set as well?
Well, when we started together in 2010, you know, we had long-term goals, and the long-term goals were really just a couple different things. At that point, it was to win another major, and it was to try to get back to number one. That was in 2010. And then you talk about those. I mean, those are discussed. We discussed that in our initial meeting, just about like, what do you want to do? You've done so much in your career already. What motive, you know, we had meetings and spend a bunch of time together just getting to know each other so I could understand his methodology. And then I could kind of plug it into Tennis Works to try to achieve those things. So those were the long-term goals that we talked about. And then it was about me understanding his process and giving suggestions about what we can and can't or should and shouldn't do to try to make sure that he maximizes his skills. And that process was really the micro reflection of what are we sticking with it? Are we making sure we stayed on track? And ultimately, when you're with great players or great athletes or anyone of excellence, if they stay on track and they keep being diligent about what their process is, the results are going to come. And that's what I talk about a lot in the book, is that I think a lot of people get so discouraged or they get insecure or create doubt, that they don't give themselves a chance to maximize whatever it is they're trying to achieve. And I think that's one of the big differences between, you know, great and good in anything. And I think great gives themselves a chance and they adjust and adapt to both success and failure in a way that allows them to maximize the opportunities so that they can kind of reach their goals.
Right, Paul. And so obviously Roger has talked about us having a unique ability to, you know, both brush off like any tough losses, let's say, and think ahead to the future. What do you think makes him be able to do that? Because, I mean, there's a lot of people who will dwell on what has happened and have that ruin their future prospects. So how does he deal with that so well?
Well, a couple things. One is he's won so much that I think that helps. I actually do think it helps. But also, I think the painful losses, especially when he was younger, he realized that, again, I'm a big believer that his life's perspective allows him so many benefits that most of us don't understand. And what I mean by that is that he genuinely really loves his life and realizes that if he doesn't win another match, his legacy is kind of fine and his life is fine. And he loves his kids. He loves his family. He loves to live his life. So that perspective allows him a freedom to compete without the fear of the what ifs, you know, like what if this happens? What if that, because he doesn't go there because he just allows him, you know, he has that liberty to go out there and kind of unconditionally compete without worrying about perceived consequences of what might happen. And that's where most of us mere mortals go wrong. We get wrapped up into that world of perceived consequences of what might happen. And that's a major reason for our downfall or shortcomings.
That's a wonderful point, Paul. And so when you step back and kind of evaluate Roger's career, you know, from that perspective, I guess his whole career, what things, it could either be technical, tactical, mental, what things did he kind of change through his whole career, his evolvement rather, that really helped him the most in becoming the great player that he is today?
Well, he's pretty interesting if you think about it, because he kind of became great at the end of the Sampras Agassi era. You know, that's kind of 2004, Andre was wrapping down. Pete really was finished. So it was more the end of the Andre era. And that's where he started being great. And so at that point, he had dealt with power and serve and volleyers, and then it started to become a different game. But for the next kind of 3 years after that, he really dominated. And then he had to start to deal with that lefty from Spain. You know, then he had to start to deal with the great Rafael Nadal, which has been a struggle for him, because Rafael Nadal, it's a really tough style matchup. It was very difficult and is very difficult to beat him. I still think the hardest thing in tennis is beating Rafael Nadal 3 out of 5 sets. The hardest thing is beating him 3 out of 5 sets on clay, but the hardest thing, second hardest thing might be beating him 3 out of 5 sets. And Roger had to wrestle with that. Then he had to wrestle with Novak and Andy. And now at 36, he's number one in the world again. He's won 3 of the last 5 majors. It's hard to really comprehend that journey to me. And I've seen a lot of it up close and personal, but I really believe so much of it is driven by his emotional disposition. You can't ever say enough about the physical athlete that he is and his ability to do things at an extremely high level, very economically and very efficiently. That's another reason why his body has lasted, is because he does things. It looks like he's floating most. I mean, he's working his backside off, but it just doesn't look so labor intensive. He's had a great trainer in Pierre Paganini since he's been 17 years old. So he's done all of the things the right way. And because of that, his abilities are still at this ridiculously high level. But I'm a big believer that most of it is driven by his emotional disposition.
Gotcha, Paul. And, you know, obviously we're all mesmerized by his movement. And I'm just wondering, you know, if somebody wants to get develop movement like that, I mean, what should they do? I mean, like, is this more of like an issue of getting a general trainer or movement specialist or changing your technique? Or, how can we kind of do that?
I think it's all the above, but I think you have to start it when you're really young. You know, I think he's always been really graceful since he's been a kid. And so you start those habits when you're young, and that allows you to get better, stronger, and faster. And those habits are ingrained in their good habits. So they just get better as you get older. But the biggest thing is getting the right kind of movement for the type of athlete you are and ingrain those habits when you're young.
Gotcha, Paul. And so, you know, before, Roger's matches, when you were kind of assessing, you know, what to do out there, can you kind of walk us through like what is a general approach or like things that you would discuss with Roger as far as like preparing for a specific opponent?
Sure. One of the things about Roger, which is great, is one of his biggest idiosyncrasies is that he doesn't have any things that he has to do all the time. In other words, sometimes we would talk about at night for a long period of time, the night before we'd go through YouTube clips and we'd do stuff, talk about, and sometimes he would say, let's just talk tomorrow at the courts for 10 minutes. So in other words, he doesn't have these superstitions that override stuff. And every time, you know, before matches, I would, you know, as we would get to tournaments, I would say, you want to chat tonight or you want to do it tomorrow? And sometimes we would, you know, just depend on how he felt. But we would mostly just talk about strengths, his strengths, and how to plug them into his opponent's weaknesses and patterns to look for. And then we would take the conditions and the environment into account and go through a few different things. And it really is pretty, it's simple insofar as he just buys into a process and you know that you can just repeat it.
That's awesome stuff, Paul. And obviously, I want to talk about your fantastic book, as we mentioned at the top of the session, which is Coaching for Life. And I just wanted to kind of ask you, you know, how the book is structured and, you know, the content inside of it.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. I appreciate the asking about it. It really is. It's kind of my journey as a tennis player and a person and a coach. What I've done is taken a lot of stuff that you're asking about and use that stuff and the players that I've coached and my own personal playing experience kind of as a metaphor for life. You know, you can't teach somebody to be a great athlete. You can't say, okay, you're going to now have Roger Federer's forehand, or you're now going to be able to hit Pete Sampras's second serve under pressure. So what I tried to do is examine really closely the traits that allowed them to maximize their skills and the processes that allowed them. And I tried to put it in a book form so that people could understand a lot of those traits are transferable no matter what you do, whether it's tennis or you want to be a lawyer or you want to be a teacher. A lot of these processes that these guys have are emotional and mental abilities that allow them to really focus in on what the task at hand is and allow them to kind of deal with any adversity or any pressure that's in front of them. So I just tried to take all of my life's experience, look at the potholes and the speed bumps that get in front of us, and try to anecdotally go through different situations where I either did it myself or I saw Pete and Roger do it, and I was able to kind of tick the box and go, wow, this is something people can really learn from. And so that's how I structured the book, with a lot of anecdotal stuff, and there were some nice stories about things that I was so fortunate enough to be able to see from a great seat with those guys and with Tim as well, because, you know, you never stop learning. And whenever you're around people like that, it's a great opportunity. I felt like I learned a ton just being with them. So, hence the idea of the book, and there it is.
Awesome, Paul. And so is there any maybe section in particular that you maybe would like to highlight for the listeners that you thought was really illuminating in respect to how helpful it would be for, you know, the reader?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, one of the biggest things is about, there's a chapter about a sense of inevitability. Champions have a sense of inevitability, which means that no matter what kind of adversity you throw at them, they're able to push all this stuff aside. They're able to sift through all of the static and all the stuff around it and then find a way to accomplish what they need to. And for me, that was a really great study, because so much of human emotion, what we do, gets wrapped up in frustration, and we can lose clarity of what we're trying to do. And those great athletes that I have been around are amazing at it. They don't get sidetracked. They don't get knocked off the horse, so to speak. And deep down inside, they believe that ultimately they're going to figure it out. I'll find a way regardless of what's in front of me. And I kind of call that a champion sense of inevitability.
Fantastic, Paul. Yeah, I think I was listening to a podcast recently about somebody who, they asked him what was the key to being great. And he said, just never give up in the face of whatever you may encounter. So wonderful advice, very motivating as well. And so we will definitely, we'll have a link below for you to check out Coaching for Life. But for those in the audience who want to find it, Paul, where is Coaching for Life? Where can they get it?
You can get it at paulanacone.com, or you can get it at amazon.com, or you can get it at irebooks.com, irebooks.com. Those are the three main places. Order it online, and there's a digital version, and read it, and write me a nice review. I could use a couple good reviews.
For sure, guys. Write Paul a review after you read his fantastic book. And so I just like to close, Paul, with asking you one final question, which is, you know, what is one key tip that our audience can just implement right now to help improve their tennis games?
The biggest thing, I think, is prioritize your goals. Prioritize the most important things and give yourself a little sense of perspective and appreciate that it's not going to happen really, really quickly. If you can do that and understand that if you're able to prioritize the goals, have some perspective about self-evaluation, you're more than likely going to get there.
Great stuff, Paul. Well, once again, truly an honor to have you on the summit. You've just had such a wonderful playing career, and you've coached such incredible athletes, and you do such great work in regards to commentating and everything. And so thanks so much for all your contributions to the tennis community. And we really appreciate you being on the summit.
Thanks so much. And I'm sure it's going to be a great summit, and everybody's going to have a good time and learn a lot. Hopefully have a good time too.
That's right. Thanks a lot, Paul.
All right. I really hope you enjoyed my interview with Paul Anacone. Again, I really appreciate everything that Paul is doing for the tennis world and for speaking with me as well, of course. So I would really appreciate it if you would subscribe to the Tennis Files podcast, and you can do that by hitting the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. For iTunes in particular, you can go to tennisfiles.com/iTunes. And I'd also like to leave you with a quote, as I often love to do, and as my video editor requested me to do. And this quote is by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, and I hope I pronounced that correctly. And Johann said, "Knowing is not enough. We must apply. Wishing is not enough. We must do." I think that's a great quote, because a lot of times you can fill yourself up with so much knowledge and yet you'll never act. You know, maybe you'll just keep researching forever, or you'll keep studying YouTube clips or reading Tennis Files or listening to the podcast or any other resources. But what you really have to do is get on the court and apply what you've learned and experiment and see what works. Because if you sit around and don't do anything, you could be the smartest person in the world, but nothing will happen for you. So I hope that you enjoy that quote as much as I do. And as always, you can go to tennisfiles.com/podcast to check out all the episodes, as well as, of course, use your podcast app, your favorite one that you use to listen to podcasts. And for this episode specifically, the show notes will be at tennisfiles.com/83. So I'm working hard to launch Tennis Summit 2019. I think that's what it's going to be named. So tentatively, that is it. That is the title. But I am still going to put out these podcast episodes too. I know in the past, I've been kind of overtaken by the summit in the last 2 years, where I haven't really been able to be as consistent as I wanted to be for the podcast. But especially with the help of my video editor this year, well, podcast and video editor, Omar, I fortunately will be able to stay consistent with everything. So with that, I implore you to get out there and improve your tennis game. And I know it's probably cold for a lot of you, including myself, but there's always indoor courts. And especially if you split it with somebody or with four people in total, it's not too bad. So anyways, with that, I wish you a very safe, healthy, and happy winter season, and I'm looking forward to putting out more great content for you to improve your tennis game, and I'll see you on the next episode of the Tennis Files podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.